Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
We had events at Old Trafford, which were fairly dramatic, and a manhunt is ongoing, according to Jose Mourinho. It's a vicious manhunt. Rio and Scalzi, chief amongst the pitchfork holders.
Out to get him.
Big time. Oh yeah, no, he's talked about the manhunt. And then we've got our Arsenal back.
Yeah, that was a significant moment of the weekend.
The cry from the fans.
Arsenal Fan TV is probably actually bombing at the moment in terms of like sort of viewership or sort of viral sensations, because no one wants cheerful fans outside the ground going, that was a great performance from the lads today. Mm. What a great goal. That's not what Arsenal Fan TV is about.
No, it's really not. If there's not outrage, there's nothing. So I don't know what they're going to do. We'll also talk about this interview that Martina Cox, wife of Sean Cox, the Liverpool fan, did with John Green over the weekend in the living section of the Sunday Independent. So she's talking about his situation and where he's at. It's fairly awful. It would make your blood boil, really. Those two strikes to the head of Sean Cox have just devastated the family completely. In short, he's moved back to Dunleary and the state will provide for 12 weeks there, and then they're on their own, effectively, the family. So they'll have to fundraise. They're targeting 2 million. It seems like Germany is the best place for rehabilitation, and so that is where they are. They've 12 weeks before, effectively, it's over to you, Cox family. Figure it out yourselves, which is just shocking, but that's...
Yeah, we'll probably talk about this a bit later. Yeah. You would hope it wouldn't necessarily come to that, in the sense that they're isolated in that way, but
yeah.
I think maybe the piece, John's piece, will probably serve a very positive purpose in terms of raising awareness.
I would think so, yeah. So let's start with Liverpool-Manchester City, which we had yesterday. Dave was at the Southampton game. Nathan and Brian Kerr were doing the game for us here yesterday. Afterwards, Jurgen Klopp, speaking at the press conference, almost felt there was an inevitability about the result, that after the humdingers of last season, eventually they were going to have to learn some defensive lessons about each other.
We played City now that often, and they are just outstanding. So, and in no game we played so far, the game was that kind of level, like it was today. Even when we won 3-0 at home, when we won 4-3 at home, it was not like... When we won 2-1 at City, they pushed us in our 18-yard box, and we didn't know exactly how to come out. Then we had our moments, of course, all that, but over the full match time, was never like that. So it's like this. It's for both teams really intense, all what we are doing here, and both showed respect for the other team. And don't lose the ball in the wrong moment, otherwise you have a big problem. And both teams did well, and then we had, how's that, a bit lucky with the penalty, of course. That's how it is, that's clear. Low rhythm, I'm not sure. For a higher rhythm, you need space. So, and both teams didn't give any space away. So against City, it's no news. If you don't defend the half spaces, then they are constantly between your midfield and your last line, and you have constantly to jump from in the last line, which you don't want to do really that often. And one situation where you allow them a 1-2, and they are alone in front of the goalie, so, or are alone in the box and shoot the ball across the line, and then somebody scores an easy goal at the second post. So that's how they score the goals. It's so difficult. It's so difficult to defend, and I'm really happy how we did it. So I'm fine, really. It was an unbelievably intense period. Our fixtures were just kind of crazy. You can never, it makes no sense to moan about it when you are in it, but now it's over, so I can moan about it. It was just unbelievable playing these teams. It's really difficult, and I'm happy with the results we got.
So some respite for Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp now as they head towards the international break. A competition, by the way, the Nations League, that Klopp called the most senseless competition in world football.
Yeah, it's Whitley's managing Germany in such 7 years. He'll be loving it.
So Pep then, before we bring in Kev, Guardiola, similar sentiments to Klopp. Both sides recognised that this was very much a title six-pointer and nobody wanted to lose. Here's Pep.
No, we know this club perfectly well, how complicated it is playing that, you know, in this stadium, and how dangerous they are, the people in front, and we control them quite well. It's always they are attacking inside and run behind, and they wait our mistake to make immediately counter-attack and play inside. They are incredible good, incredible quick. And we control the back four. We're outstanding today in terms of controlling our build-up as well. But after that, we didn't create too much in the people in front, you know, but it is normal because they are so strong. And but that, okay, it's a point. We were close more than ever to win here, but okay, it's better than last season, like we lose. And especially when we spoke, try to be ourselves all the time, and we did it. We compete really, really good. We had our chance. Okay, so it's what it is. We want to create, you know, we're going to do something, but they wait when you make a mistake and in this kind of situation. We like to make the process, to build up, to create the spaces. It's not easy, but if it's an open game in Anfield or an open game against Liverpool, you don't have not even one chance, not even 1%. But they are so good. They play for that. And we control it through Riyad, because the guy can give you extra pass, Bernardo in the middle to give you an extra pass. And it's important to give that pace to, because it's up and down quickly. They are much, much better. They are I'm pretty sure the best team in the world running these transitions, offensive, defensively. They are not team better than the world than that, because it's built for that. It's created for that. It's what Jurgen feels. And of course, the players they build, they take, it's for that sense. And in that situation, they are much better than us.
So that's Guardiola. Kevin Kilbane joins us this evening, sir.
Hi, Joe. How you keeping?
Yeah, very well. So both managers there with plenty of experience talking about just how few mistakes they can afford to make against each other. And that attitude really dominated throughout the game.
Yeah, it was a strange watch, I think. Certainly after the first 10 or 15 minutes, seeing Liverpool really get on the front foot like we've seen them start so many times. Real high energy, high-paced football. But it was more so Man City, watching how they maybe adapted. And I think Pep Guardiola had spoken the lead-up to say, look, we don't do 0-0 draws. We don't do no shots. We don't do no goals. That was a standout thing, what Guardiola was saying, because clearly he had a plan. Clearly he had a way to be a little bit deeper, deny space in behind. The mistakes that City were making was giving the ball away. That was what was costing them early on the match. And Liverpool, in transition, we know that, as maybe Guardiola said, they're probably one of the best, if not the best at that, how quickly they can counter against it. But it was certainly a different City performance. I think I read today, Joe, as well, the lowest percentage of possession since Guardiola's taken over. I think that was quite interesting. The fact is, you know, I wouldn't be one for possession stats as much, but I just think it was interesting seeing Guardiola and how he set his side up. And I think the longer the game went, I know they missed the penalty later on, City grew into the game brilliantly. And I thought they started to dominate, I think, for long spells, particularly from, say, 20, 25 minutes onwards.
Yeah. Their lowest possession percentage under Pep, but still 51%.
It's not bad, is it? Yeah, it's not bad. You know, it's, I mean, still, you look at it, though, you see the top five in the Premier League at the moment, and it's what we've been looking for. Now, whether or not it goes like this beyond Christmas, 2 points separating the top five. It's only Man United that's out of it there. I mean, it's looking good. That's the way that I will see it. After the first eight games of the season, it's looking great, I think, towards the back end of the season now. I think this is, we hope that they can all maintain it, particularly when you look to Arsenal. I know we'll maybe get into that later. But looking at the side, and you're seeing them, Joe, I think, particularly City and Liverpool, I think they're both playing a great brand of football and it looks good for the rest of the season.
Yeah. How do you evaluate City this far into the season? Like, they're just not going to do what they did last year. So have they gone backwards?
Well, it doesn't look that way now, does it? That's the thing. If you asked me at the start of the season, I'd say they're going to take some stopping. It'll be a continuation for them. But it hasn't been a continuation. I think they've had spells where they've just wiped the floor with a few of the lower sides. But no, they're not at it. They're not at it like we saw them last season. I think that's fair to say. Chelsea's probably the surprise one out of the lot that's at the top, because I don't think we saw Chelsea going from the level they were at last season to the highs they're at now and playing the brand of football that they are playing.
Mm. It's a strange one, Kev, because I don't know if you agree. I take exactly what you're saying about City. Yet if they stick away that penalty, you know, if Mahrez sticks that penalty away yesterday, we're probably talking today about City, well, not at their best, but they've gone to the home of their, you know, perceived main rival, and they've been very good in terms of, you know, neutralising them, and then a smash and grab win. And maybe the tone of our discussion is completely different today if they go and do that. And I don't know if that shows still that City are that bit ahead of Liverpool in terms of their maturity in that match yesterday.
Yeah, I think it was Gary Neville saying in commentary, I think ideally both managers about 70 minutes would snap your hand off for a 0-0 draw. I think that would have been fair to say, take your point, get on with it. But you're right in saying it, that if City go there, do a job on Liverpool, get a 1-0 win, come away from the match and you think, right, here we go now. We've got now a sizable lead over Liverpool. We now have played against our main rivals, what we would have thought at the start of the season. We've gone to their patch and got a result. So, yeah, we would have thought differently, but I still think it's a good result for City and for Liverpool regardless, because I think Neville commented on the fact is, look, just keep your powder dry. Everything's good towards the back end of the season. And now we could see fireworks beyond Christmas, because there'll be so much pressure ramped up for every single game that we'll probably see points dropped when it's unlikely or you're least expecting the points to be dropped.
Mm. Pep Guardiola apologised for overruling Jesus, who wanted to take the penalty, who has taken penalties before for Manchester City. He said that Mahrez strikes them beautifully in training all the time, and he felt Mahrez was the man to do it. I can't say I had any big reservation over Mahrez when he was standing over the ball at all. You know, he's such a beautiful striker of the ball. How many times have we seen him cut in on his left foot or hit free kicks?
Yeah.
But then suddenly Sky Sports put the graphic up of his recent record and you realise, oh, actually, he's rubbish at these things when it comes down to it. And then, lo and behold, off he went. It was a terrible, terrible penalty. He was leaning completely back. I mean, everything about it was ugly.
Yeah, he just went for pure power, didn't he? That's where I think you go for pure power when you're not confident, or the occasion's probably getting to you. I used to hear Andy Gray say that years ago. He said, head over the ball, just hit it true, strike through it. I'd probably say that Mahrez is a better striker of the ball than Jesus, and I would prefer to go with Mahrez than Jesus. I'm more of the fact is, and I would, something that I've always said to you, I think the best strikers of the ball are probably fullbacks that I would have played with over the years. And the truer strikers of the ball or holding midfielders, they're the most truer strikers of the ball. I wouldn't necessarily say that a striker is the truer striker of the ball, because they're not naturally getting the ball from back to front. They're not naturally slotting a ball into midfield. It's about finishing moves off. Yes, comfortable in one-on-one positions, and they have that little feeling to finish beyond goalkeepers, but they're not the most truer strikers of a ball.
Mm. I was trying to think, who would I want to take the penalty? Like, Silva doesn't jump out at me massively either, I have to say.
Would you not feel a bit more confident if Silva strikes up? I think exactly what Kev's saying about sort of is it entirely natural in terms of the ball striker, but I don't know, it's easy to say you're a genius after the event, but there was something about Mahrez's body language and his run-up even that was like, oh no.
Yeah, I'd have Silva sort of in the Jesus character, you know? I'd much prefer Silva to flick him with the outside of his boot around a corner than slot away a penalty.
We were having the conversation about Aguero. Was it the start of last season where he missed about 3 penalties out of 5 or something? I don't know the stat off the top of my head, but he was missing penalties for fun, Aguero, and all of a sudden then you're looking at your midfield. Personally, I'm probably with you there on Silva. I think Silva, more naturally a gifted striker of the ball, him or Mahrez would be probably the ideal two to take penalties, but Mahrez's record is poor, and that can get the better of you sometimes. Sometimes that can be just a mental thing rather than actually the execution.
Well, I think it is, because Guardiola said he strikes them beautifully in training all the time. And you can imagine him. You can imagine him hooking him into that left-hand corner all the time, almost as if he's cut in from the right wing. And then you can even imagine him last minute hooking them into the other corner if he feels the keeper's going the right way. Like, you can just see him striking beautiful penalties in training. It's obviously such a different thing when you're doing it in a Premier League ground with millions of people watching you.
Yeah, it is. No matter what you think, when those pressurised moments are there and you're standing over the ball and you're taking big penalties, it is. It's mentally just get your technique right. And for all that, and I've heard it, and I'll take it on board to an extent of, look, get your practice on your technique, striking a ball, striking penalties. And I've heard it said many, many times, you'll never be able to replicate that type of situation, that pressurised moments. You can't replicate it, because at times in training, you could hit 10 out of 10 in a top corner, not a bother at all, and you're 20 out of 20, 100 out of 100. But that one moment, when that pressure is clearly on you, you do clam up that little bit and you don't strike it as naturally as you would do it under normal circumstances.
Manchester United rallied brilliantly to beat the team second from bottom. So it's big progress there.
Yeah. What did you think of that, Joe? Well, do you know the reason why I reference the top five there, Joe, is because you, with your elitist football, you'll always go for the top five. Looking at the top five now, Man United just out of it, yeah, but this is ideal for you now, isn't it, towards the end of the season? You don't have to bother about the rest of the Premier League now.
It was still quite stunning, given the circumstances, just how woeful they were at the back again and how dishevelled. And Ashley Young looks about 40 at the moment. He just can't seem to get close to anybody. The general situation is not helping him. And that is ultimately the problem. And then Baye's been substituted off, and McTominay's been told, sorry mate, back you go again. And at one stage, Pogba's turning up as a centre defence sweeper type thingy. He doesn't even know himself. And you're kind of looking over at Mourinho and you're thinking, you've been here for 3 years. This is just absolute car crash stuff. And then the second half happens, and it's hard to know what to make of it. What looms large, I suppose, is Chelsea up next, then Juventus, then Everton. Bournemouth away will be no fun. And then they have Juventus again. And then just really to finish him off, if he's not gone by then, it's Manchester City. They cannot go into these games defending like this.
No, do you know what, Joe? I was talking to Dan, was on the show on Saturday. I was talking to Tommy and Johnny that were on as well. We were talking about the amount of times he's changed the side. It's not necessarily about him changing the side offensively. Yeah, he's going to have to change people, keep them fresh. But defensively, is Mourinho, through his career, has constantly had a back four in place. And unless there's an injury, it's not going to change that back four. You've got a solid back four in place, organised, so difficult to play against. If one fullback has gone forward on one side, the other fullback, you can guarantee, will never get forward. He will tuck round, and he'd have a holding midfield that would sit in, that would always have that base of four defensive players, and then you could use the other six players from the attacking side of it. Where all of a sudden now you're seeing United. Now, he's mentioned this in the last few weeks, where he's mentioned about distribution from back to front or playing out from the back. He hasn't got players good enough to do that. But that's never really been Jose Mourinho's style. Like, as far as I've watched him over these, it's been about being solid, difficult to play against. Now, so why all of a sudden now is he getting away from what he was actually good at in organising a side and making them difficult to play against and difficult to play through? He's getting away from that. Now, I understand being a Man United manager, you might have to adapt in certain ways, but you can still have the fundamentals, do the basics right, get your side defensively organised, and have an attacking side to your game. And I don't understand why he's continuously chopped and changed that.
There is the PR award as well, which is amazing, really. Like, I'm stunned that he has managed to win this so comprehensively amongst the fans, it seems, because the crowd started chanting, Jose's right, the board is shite. Not the greatest chant in the history of football chants, but, you know.
It's not the worst, though, is it?
No, they felt it was a temporary but necessary one. And Ed Woodward sitting there with his arms crossed. And then Mourinho comes out afterwards and talks about an orchestrated campaign. He's talking about Rio Ferdinand and Paul Scholes in particular here, who've been hitting him hard on BT lately. And he's talking about a wicked manhunt. A lot of wickedness, too much wickedness in something that should be beautiful, he says. And he says of his team then, I think some of the boys, they are not the man that is hunted. I think they're not coping well, though, and they've started panicking. I cope with it with some sadness, obviously, and I survive. I'm mature. I'm a big boy. But some of the boys, Rashford, was sad on the pitch. Rashford was sad on the pitch. Scott McTominay was scared, and even all the players, they committed mistakes that are not normal. And he's levelled this at Rio and Scholes' door. Ferdinand said, I don't know where the wickedness and manhunt come from. I don't know what he's talking about. When you manage Manchester United, you have to expect that there'll be scrutiny, especially if things are going wrong. If things are going wrong, you're going to be under intense scrutiny. And you think that is fair enough. I don't necessarily think it's a manhunt. Really, what Mourinho does have in his locker, though, is Gary Neville, who's been out front and centre for the last couple of weeks, calling out Ed Woodward and made that very emotional contribution on Sky Sports on Friday evening. And the crowd now, despite the terrible football and the toxic atmosphere for 3 years, are right there on Mourinho's side. And Ed Woodward is feeling the pressure. So politically, what's going on at Old Trafford is quite fascinating, actually. Every bit as fascinating as it is terrible on the pitch.
Yeah, it is. What he's going to give. We've seen this battle between the star player and the manager then and the board. Clearly, he's got an issue with the board. He's had that for a number of months now. Mm. You'd probably say even beyond that. Why they deemed it necessary to give him the 3-year contract at the stage he did last season, I don't know. Why couldn't they wait till the end of the season, assess the season as a whole, and then take it forward? I don't know, but that's another issue. I think it is interesting to see how Neville and Ferdinand and Scholes, realistically, maybe speaking to Scholes over the years, I don't think Scholes has got an agenda. I think he's just himself. I think he shoots from the hip, that's it. Maybe they all don't have an agenda. Maybe I'm guessing a bit, but I think in general, words have been had when they're going on air or before they're going on air, look, we might need to taper this down a bit, we might need to take this down a bit. That's the way that I'm reading it, because the message from Neville over the last couple of years has been constantly talking about what's going on the pitch. Now, fair enough, he might feel as though he needs to address what's going on off it, and because of his experience, maybe albeit lower league and in the business world, I understand that. But in general, the message from Neville is clearly different, and it's certainly different from what it was, I think, a year ago anyway. So
yeah, no, it's shifted. It's definitely shifted. He's gone from focusing on the pitch. Like, Scholes and Rio are still talking about the performances and Mourinho, for sure, and how bad
the football is. Which is right. Which is right, it is. In fairness, so.
Neville has shifted in the last... Well, from this season, really, actually, I think. Neville has left what's on the pitch away to a point, and he's shone a light on Woodward. Like, you remember, he went on Sky Sports and he completely changed the narrative a couple of weeks ago when everybody was talking about Mourinho, and Neville went on Monday Night Football and picked out Woodward sitting in the stand after a bad result with his arms crossed, even long after the final whistle. And Neville said, you know, this stinks, this is wrong. If you're the Manchester United chairman like this, you get up, you shake the hands of the opposing chairman and you get out of the stand. You don't make a statement. And he's continually said he's had issues with the Manchester United board. Like, on Friday, he made the point...
That's something that would have wound me up, that scene. That was a clear statement from Woodward there.
He's
spot on there. Get off, just get yourself to, you know, have words with the manager, do it in private. Don't necessarily make that type of statement. I was with him there on that one.
And Neville on the Friday night in Sky, when it came out, it seemed that Mourinho was going to be sacked regardless, that Daily Mirror story, he said it like it's a disgrace. He said, effectively, the only two people at that club who could overrule Mourinho on any football decision are Sir Bobby Charlton and Sir Alex Ferguson, and they weren't consulted for sure over any centre-backs. So Neville has basically said the Manchester United board is not fit for purpose. And without naming Woodward, he's basically said Woodward is not fit for purpose. And Manchester United fans listen to Gary Neville, that's for sure. Neville said on the Friday, Mourinho's going to get so much support at Old Trafford because of this Daily Mirror story. Wait and you see. And it became almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. The Manchester United fans, I would think, said, yeah, you know, that's, we don't want our club run like this. So I would think they don't particularly like what Mourinho's doing. But the only people outdoing Mourinho in awfulness is the Manchester United board at the moment.
Yeah, but you know what, Joe? I think... It's taken us away from what we've seen on the pitch for the last 5 years. This is not a new thing. I'm not being funny. Jose Mourinho, yes, he won the trophies two seasons ago, didn't he? Winning the Europa League and the Carling Cup was it at the time, Carabao Cup. I don't know what it was at the time. But the theme has been constant throughout. United have played the same type of football throughout, and yeah, I understand that. Fair enough that you maybe question the board then and the appointments that they're making, but who else was out there before Mourinho was going to take that job? I wouldn't necessarily question Woodward and his appointments. That's the way that I would think. You could maybe question David Moyes, only in the fact is that with the experience that he had at managing at that you know, right at the very top. But bringing Van Gaal in, was that probably the right appointment? Yes, Mourinho probably was. So I think in general, if I'm looking at the side is not necessarily been performing any different in the last 5 years or so since Ferguson's gone. That's just the way that it is.
Kev, we spoke about this briefly on Saturday as well, but do you think it's sort of mad how much the former United players have become a part of the debate around the club? The class of 92 gang, I know Rio's not in that, but you know, Scholes, Gary Neville, that Gary Neville is like at the centre of the Manchester United debate. Like, you can't really... Yeah. He is like a player in the game. He's not a pundit offering his views. Like, he's actually part of the discussion. Like, it's part of the coverage. It's part of everything. Yeah. You're waiting for his response. And, like,
Neville has dictated the focus away from Mourinho onto the board like nobody else could have.
And is this a plan here?
I don't know what's going on.
I think, Kev, you might think, what actually is happening here with that?
Well, no, it does, Dan. I said it to the weekend. It, you know, if I wasn't so cynical, you'd suggest that he's angling in a way to try to get onto that board. But with what he's saying, all of a sudden they have this meeting. He's a very powerful man. He's a very, he's in touch with the fans. Clearly, he's got a lot of pull, as we're saying here. Whatever he says, there's a constant message that he's giving out that's been supported by I would say, probably a majority of Man United supporters. So, Is he that one that all of a sudden now that Ed Woodward is not flavour of the month, he's not well liked by United fans, there's been an agenda against him now. Now, whatever his background is, I know that his background is not necessarily the recruitment side of it. His background, I believe, was in the marketing side, and that's where he's had major success across his career. So there might be something there that Neville can say, look, I can fill a gap there, or if they were ever to approach him. That's the way that you'd read it. If I was cynical, that is, I'd maybe think that.
No, I'm starting to read it the same way. I would not be shocked if there's a Gary Neville-led consortium in the next couple of years. I really wouldn't, the way it's all shaping.
Yeah.
You watched Fulham 1, Arsenal 5. The Arsenal fans were chanting, "We've got our Arsenal back, Kev."
Yeah. Did you see any of it, Joe?
I was doing the Sunday papers. Although the few times I looked up, Robbie Fowler on Sky Sports was calling out Cyrus Christie in particular for bad defending. He really was. That's the only thing I can mention. Did you watch it on TV or were you there?
Yeah, I watched it on TV. He got caught out, Joe. He got caught out a few times getting forward. But that's just the way that the manager plays, isn't it? Jokanović plays like that. Much as the same I spoke about Marina early on, that if one fullback goes forward, it's the old style way, your other one tucked around. That's certainly not Jokanović's way. He's prepared to leave himself two-on-two defensively. And I've never really seen an Arsenal side in transition or, you know, winning the ball back, how quickly they're countering against side. It was Arsenal's way of breaking sides down was I felt, laborious football at times. Yeah. It wasn't a great watch. Now, all of a sudden, they can do that. They're playing out from the back. We've seen them trying it this season, which they have been caught out with. But now, they are devastating when they're countering against side. And Lacazette is beginning to look the player that we saw at Lyon. He's not necessarily seen it consistently across his time. Iwobi, who Kenny's spoken about over the last couple of years, hasn't he, about this player that he thinks is going to go on to be a superstar. He's now looking like an incredible footballer, like the player that Kenny saw a while and he's not been able to produce it consistently. The holding midfield lad, what's his name, the Uruguayan boy?
Lucas Torreira,
Torreira, I mean, what a player. He looks just unreal. He does, honestly, breaking up play, that's his game, winning balls back quickly and getting it forward. And now all of a sudden we're seeing an Arsenal side that when they win the ball back, it's not quick, short passes. And dare I say that when Ozil's in the side, that's what you get, slowing the game down. Much as the same you see, I think, with Pogba at United at times, slowing games down. Ozil does that for Arsenal. Now, all of a sudden, he's not in the side yesterday and you've got quick, direct football when you're in transition. And that is where a lot of the goals came from yesterday. The football was just brilliant, but also defensively, how well organised they were.
It's amazing, really. So they're 6 in a row in the Premier League. They're 9 in a row in all competitions. They're keeping pace with some fairly serious teams. I mean, they're 2 points off. They're level with Spurs. And you're seeing no reason in the short term why that's going to stop anytime soon.
I like watching them yesterday, Joe. How many times have I come into you and we've been chatting away and it's like, oh, it's
they're boring and they're slow and they're frustrating.
It is. That's how it was. We're all of a sudden now you're seeing an exciting Arsenal side. Lads prepared to put foot in as well. That's another thing. They're actually scrapping and fighting. They've got one or two players in there that are prepared to do that. And not necessarily what we've seen from someone like Xhaka over the last year or two, where it's like crap fouls, where he's getting sent off, where he's clipping people's heels twice. And now all of a sudden they're getting booked for real tackles. That's the way that I would see it. And they're looking... Yeah, I think they're looking good. And now, whether or not they're going to... I don't think they'll keep pace. I don't think they're as good as Liverpool. I don't think they're as good as City. Even Chelsea, I don't think they've got that steel about them. But top four now, I'm thinking top four at best... top six at best for Arsenal at the start of the season. Now, you're thinking they've got a real chance of top four, yeah?
Listen, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it, Kev.
Good, man. Congratulations on Sports Broadcaster of the Year as well. Again, Joe, again. What is it? Is that 5 and 6, is it?
4 and 5.
4 and 5, yeah.
He knew that stat. Yeah.
It means a lot to you, Joe. I know that.
It means everything. I can die happy. Right, go away. Goodbye.
Football on Off the Ball. Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Welcome back. Gone full-time in Turner's Cross?
Yeah, Cork City are through to the FAI Cup final to play Dundalk for the 26th time in a row, or maybe the 4th time in a row, something like that. There's been more Dundalk, as many Dundalk-Cork finals as Joe Malloy Broadcaster Awards, Joe, you know? 4 and 4 even a better record than yours. But Bowes scored an amazing goal. No matter what time anyone listens to this, they would have probably seen a clip of the Ian Morris goal by now for Bowes, sort of a 40-yarder in off the underside of the bar. And that gave Bowes hope from being 2-0 down at half-time. But they pushed at the end. They brought on this player called Ali Regba. He's a teenage striker of sort of Algerian, born in Germany, Algerian parentage, I think Irish as well, and a talented player and a name to remember, I think. He came on and sort of... a few nice touches towards the end, but Bowes just left themselves with too much of a mountain to climb. So yeah, Cork Dundalk, November the 4th, fourth year in a row. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a hard job to sell it, but they are still the two best teams in the country, so you hope that the FAI make a good job. They have cancelled all football in Ireland that day in terms of amateur football, and they're trying to run promotions in terms of getting kids free tickets for any schoolboy club in the country. I think what adults you get X amount of tickets, and I think that's a good thing. They've been talking about doing that for years, and yeah, and hopefully, you know, they make an effort to fill the stadium, because it's going to be hard. There's going to be a bit of fatigue, I think, from maybe floating fans who've, you know, they've seen this show before, I guess.
Yeah. We mentioned Sean Cox at the top of the show, Liverpool fan. John Green of the Sunday Independent spoke with Martina Cox, Sean's wife, at the weekend. First time I think the Cox family have ever sat down and done anything in-depth, and it's a very in-depth piece, and it's well worth a read. It's on the Irish Independent website. Yeah, Sean Cox blindsided as he stood on the street, says John. He was struck by two rapid, savage blows to the right side of his head. He never stood a chance. He was hit with such brutal force that it's very likely he was already unconscious as he started falling, landing hard, hitting his head on the road. Martin Cox threw himself on top of his stricken brother to protect him from further blows. He was kicked several times as he shielded Sean. So that was how this nightmare started. John Green paints a picture of the family being at home doing their various bits on a standard Champions League evening, the stuff we all do. Someone's cooking dinner, someone's at football training, someone's doing something else, and the phone call comes. And initially there's a sense that, oh, is he okay? Can't be that big, you know, he's probably okay. Maybe someone gave him a bang, but he's okay. So they talk about the vigil by his bed, three children, Jack 21, Sean at 20, Emma 17, spending as much time as possible with them over in Liverpool. They said he's not going to wake up immediately. He's going to take a long time. It's a slow process. So we just sat through it. You just keep hoping that he's going to come around. Very hard to watch your loved one lying there knowing that somebody has done this to him. So eventually Sean Cox did wake up, but it's been painstaking. And that's what comes across in the piece. Initially opening his eyes for a few seconds, and then at one stage it was a few minutes, and they say in the piece we felt like he'd won the lotto, you know. And it's just so heartbreaking for the family, really. So in the Walton Centre over in England, he's out of consciousness basically a lot of the time, so they encourage families to keep a daily log. So it's called the patient's diary, where you chronicle each day's events, no matter how small, and then the patient, the hope is they leave and then they'll come back at a later date when they're well enough and read through it about their time there, you know. And so some of the entries say things like, "Hi Dad, it's my 21st birthday. Me, Mam and Richard are going to Nando's for dinner." Mm. Like this poor family over in Liverpool, the horror of it. Where he is now, he went to Beaumont, and the flickers became a little more prolonged, says John Green. There was a new sense of hope. And over the summer, he had pneumonia, and then that was thankfully consigned to the past. More progress made. Started to move his right hand and arm, then his right leg. So what Martina says at one point is, he can lift his right arm. It's weak, but he can lift it. He can hold a ball. If we give him the phone, and if he's looking at photos, he knows to flick through them. Ironically, he's left-handed. His strength was in his left arm, but his right arm has become the main thing. Obviously, he does everything with the right arm. His right leg is now active. He can move it up and down. The left leg is the main problem, because he was struck on the right side of his brain. Still not sitting up, can move himself a little bit. They say to him, "Sean, try and move yourself," and he'll try and push. And he's always pushing more with the right side, because the left side is the weak side. He can't enunciate in any way, can't project his voice out.
He can whisper it. He's conscious of stories, isn't he? That he's people are talking and he's, you know, smiling or seems to be processing what's been said to him, but as you mentioned, he can't communicate his thoughts, which is, you know, there's a glimmer of light with that, and then the utter sort of frustration and the sort of pain of that, and it sort of comes across in their words.
The doctors think, I mean, it's hard for them to tell, that he's experienced double or treble vision. I mean, imagine that. I mean, on top of everything else, the horror of that. He's better now at expressing himself, said Martina's wife. He's definitely more alert now than he has been. He has a few words, but it's very limited, very low, almost like a whisper. He would say yes and no. And he actually said sore shoulder once, but he can't string a sentence. He's talking a bit, but we don't know what he's saying because it's gibberish, which is really upsetting. And I'd say it's very frustrating for Sean. He just can't get the words out. So
The thing about, I mean, obviously it's unbelievably horrific, and you know, particularly, you know, there'll be so many people listening, and you know, it is a big part of, you know, an Irish engagement with football, is that we all probably know someone who's gone over to a game in Anfield or Old Trafford, or it's been you, it's been yourself, and it's not something that's synonymous with danger. I mean, that's part of the Premier League experience now relative to 20, 30 years ago, that the grounds aren't associated with this, you know, you never hear of someone go over for a game, and you never think, "Oh, mind yourself." You know, that doesn't even cross your radar to think that this could be some kind of threatening event. Not like going away to Moscow or something for Turkey for some intimidating away tie. Obviously, this piece has delivered a reaction. It's social media can be sort of a corrosive influence, but there are times where it can be very positive. And there's obviously a way of, part of this and is that trying to raise awareness of, well, what are Liverpool doing now? Because the family now need to raise a lot of money. They're facing real challenges around the corner here. And I suppose, John didn't go mad on it, but also mentioning in the piece that Liverpool were very helpful in the early days in terms of helping out with flights and so on. But there's a sense that the family are a small bit on their own now. Now, through this piece going out there, there's been people raising this, contacting people at Liverpool. I think Tony Barrett, sort of ex-journalist, is involved as a supporter liaison. And I would suspect now that this will lead to Liverpool getting involved. It's just my feeling that Liverpool have a huge presence on social media. They're one of the biggest clubs for that. And when these causes become a thing, they tend to build their own momentum. And I'd be very, very disappointed if this didn't lead to some form of action. What that action may be, we shall see. Because in some ways, I do slightly sympathise with clubs, as much as they're multi-million pound industries, that if you're seen to help with one case, then all of a sudden, you did that, and then something else comes up. And I know, because there's an Irish case here, we're very drawn naturally emotionally towards it. That is a slight difficulty for the club, but at the same time, I'd be shocked if they didn't come in to help and do something with this.
Yeah, I'd agree totally. So Wednesday just gone, the last road in Sean's road to recovery was when he was transferred to the National Rehabilitation Hospital in Dunleary. They'd been waiting for a bed there for some time. The programme in Dunleary is 12 weeks, and that's state covered, and then you are on your own after that. It's private, and they talked maybe about Germany being the best place for rehabilitation. They've targeted 2 million.
Mm.
Again, you feel like Liverpool will do something. I mean, Roma, maybe they should do something as well here.
Yeah, no, I think
under the circumstances, don't you think?
I think so. Again,
considering they deal with these absolute, I don't want to say anything which even a tiny bit prejudices a court case which is upcoming, but considering it was a Roma fan and these ultras seem to be tolerated by the club.
They do. I think if people go to a game in Italy, there's probably a sense of mind yourself. Sometimes we've discussed this before, that, I mean, maybe they're, in some ways immune to thinking about this being a serious episode, and obviously patently is, you would like to see a gesture as well of some kind, but again, the family haven't spoken really until now. They're speaking now, and I think people maybe are now, I think people might even, to be fair, heard reports of sort of improvement for Sean Cox and probably didn't grasp. I remember there was a story a while back about him coming out of sort of regaining consciousness, and I think that maybe led people who just drifted away from the story to think that everything was going to be okay.
Yeah.
And I think that this piece is timely in terms of reminding people that that is not the case.
Yeah.
And I would sort of expect a response to
that. I'm sure it's no coincidence that Martina's chosen to do the piece now. And she even says herself, the focus has now changed. For me, the focus was on Sean recovering, and now all of a sudden we've been plunged into something else, which is both the court case, which she plans on attending, and also life after the next 12 weeks in Dunleary, which will fly by. God, Christmas is about 12 weeks away, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. So there's a GoFundMe page, and I'm sure if you go onto the Independent website, you can get a link to it there, and I'm sure everything would be welcome. And then we'll see what Liverpool do. We'll see what funding happens. So, that's worth a read. The interview with Martina Cox, wife of Sean.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.